Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week, we break down trends using the lens of culture to determine what's significant to your future and why.
Hey, man. Good to be with you on another expedition. The Dope Boys Insurgency. The Dope Boys Militia.
We riding on them asses.
Growing. Super producer Matt Leck. And everybody knows, well, if you're new on this journey with us, maybe you don't know yet, but our loyalists know, and you will know, that we always got to have, well, 99% of the time, sometimes it's just got to be me and Phil to get back to the root, but 99% of the time, we have a member of our illustrious crew with us, and I am very, very happy, as I always am, to have Mr. Rob Fields himself here for the third time.
Wow.
Or is this, no, this is the fourth time.
Yeah, fourth time.
Man. Wow.
Four-timer.
Yeah, man, no
better
doubt.
Than being a two-timer.
Oh, that is doubt. Much yeah, better absolutely. Than
that's what all the ladies say.
That's what I hear. I don't know. I've been married happily for a long time. Put that in there.
You can still get positive feedback even as a married man. There's no contradiction.
Great to be here. We are on that ride. I guess we're going already.
Much love to all of the married people. I hold down the opposite end. All right.
There it is. There
Rob,
it is.
We give the 10 seconds, 20 seconds on you just for the new people that are joining us.
Yes. I mean,
everybody knows you're dope.
Thank you. And Rob Fields, I am a marketer, cultural curator. I run a media site called Bold as Love, which focuses on music and culture and Afropunk and anything black, left, and progressive. And I work in marketing and all good.
Also a four-timer.
And a four-timer.
Not a two-timer. Phil, we got to get to the brand F-up.
Brand
of speaking F-up. Of two-timers.
Here we are.
Let's get to the brand F-up.
Yo, the Red Cross is racist.
That kind of doesn't surprise me.
And there,
I don't know why. I don't know where I got that gene where I'm just uniform. Like, I bet.
I'm sure there's a lot of like...
Can we just cite that right there? That was real subtle. He said it's the uniform.
It is. It's always the uniform, man. In all seriousness, kind of, sort of. The Red Cross has now issued an apology, but the headline screams, racist pool safety poster brings Red Cross apology. And the just a little background for those who might not have seen this. The Red Cross Hospital, based out of Colorado, basically produced a poster that was designed to depict the proper way for young people, kids, to follow the rules of pool safety. And it was called Be Cool, Follow the Rules.
Racist. And below,
yeah.
Oh, so, no, I guess I shot ahead.
Yeah, you're too early. Too early. Okay. But with that in mind, the heading, like I said, is Be Cool, Follow the Rules. And to read a little bit from this article, which is USA Today, before the heading, information was depicted of the children playing. The white children in this ad were labeled as behaving cool, in quotations, while children of color were depicting as misbehaving or not cool for breaking pool safety rules. So for those who are looking for this visual, just picture a animated depiction of a pool, and you have kids doing various activities within that pool. Those who are depicted as white kids, they're kind of peachy pink colored, are cool. And those who kind of look like Franklin from Charlie Brown are depicted as not cool. And I think we have some audio.
This is a report, I believe, is from Good Morning America, I want to say. This was how flagrant this was, that this got into the morning news roundup. By the way, this is not on point of us because we have a follower and listener who's on Twitter who gave us this brand F up. I don't have the name in front of me, but I'll try to get it later. It's from the Today Show. Excuse me. Not, what's the difference between the Today Show and Good Morning America?
That's NBC the real question. NBC versus ABC.
Yeah, that's about it. That's
semantics. All right.
Outside of that, they're all nonsense.
But we're still available for consulting services, Phil. Okay, let's play that clip.
Finding itself in a little hot water this morning over a pool safety poster. Here's the image from a Red Cross hospital out in Colorado. The title, Be Cool, Follow the Rules, breaks down pool safety into a couple of different behaviors. Cool, meaning smart behavior, and not cool for possibly rude or dangerous behavior. Here's the problem. Users on social media notice that many of the white children are labeled cool, meaning they're following the rules, while a majority of the darker-skinned children are branded not cool for being rule breakers. Folks online are calling this racist. Now the Red Cross is responding, pulling the poster and apologizing. The organization says it plans to do better in the future.
We have lots of brown people.
Yeah.
Cool or not cool?
Probably nobody really took a good look at it.
I don't think,
What if it was a marketing person?
Yeah. Well, it's often probably, and we don't know, but that's why they say diversity we know is so important. If there's a diverse body of people, maybe those things don't get by. I don't know who put it together, but that is usually part of it. Oh, well, okay. So
yeah, that's what we say, Tamman Hall. Stop biting our content.
Exactly. And, and just real quick, just give a shout out to Ryan Garner, at Ryan L. Garner. He was the gentleman who shot us over this brand F up. So shout out to Ryan, and also, you know, look him up, man. Pretty cool dude. He's listening. He's a loyal listener.
He's a loyal, he's making a smart dude.
Yeah, making us smarter.
Making us smarter. So what's our review on this, gentlemen?
I have to agree with Tamron Hall agreeing with us that diversity is, people think that having diverse people in ads, this came up at Con as well. The Con Lions were just this week, the advertising's industry's biggest event in the world. Like, every agency's there, all the heads of major brands are there. And there were a couple of events that happened off that really brought the diversity issue to the fore. And Cindy Gallup, who used to be the chairman or chairperson of BBH New York, and has gone on to be a real advocate for sex positive culture and as well as ad business diversity, raised a point where it's not enough to just have a variety of people of color in your ads. You have to have them in the room, you know, and that's what the diversity issue is really about, because there are just some things that you might not see, you know, whether it's as a guy knowing what something looks like when visually depicted to a woman, or as a white person knowing how a person of color might see something. And so it's just in everybody's best interest to have greater diversity in the room. And diversity sounds like such a cop-out and such a namby-pamby word, but it really does matter in a world that is global.
Yeah, I think I mean, my three quick thoughts on it. I mean, one, this is this is almost, you know, sometimes we try to find ones that are a little bit more tricky or a little bit more subtle. I mean, this is like sort of, I mean, if it was in a movie, I would think it was very funny. Yeah. It looks like something out of a comedy sketch or something. It's kind of shocking how blatant it is. But an apology is nothing. This apology, I think, would only mean something if it was really followed with a really clear plan of action and implementation, because it really is genuinely mind-blowing that this would go through.
And to their, I don't mean to cut you off, but just to their credit, you know, there is a white guy walking around the pool with an open bottle. So there's one misbehaving white guy there.
That was me. The other two things that I would say really quickly is, I think, you know, I make this point always as the addition to diversity, not in replacement or in lieu of, obviously, but the addition. I'm just a basic attitude of curiosity in all of these situations from everybody, because, you know, like, even when we were talking about Adidas recently, and it's like, yes, you need Colombians in the room, but you know what? You also just need people who are, you know, when Colombians are working on the account that involves, you know, Hong Kong, they should be intellectually curious people.
Absolutely.
And everybody needs to have that kind of empathy. And it just kind of blows my mind that we don't see it. It comes from diversity. And I think it also comes from a certain mentality that we need to cultivate in our communities through diversity, and also through ourselves in terms of our sort of outlook and approach to life. But I mean, it was I saw it, and I really, actually, my biggest research on it was like, is this a joke? And are we about to do a mess up on this segment because this isn't real?
Well, us in the Today Show.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's true. It's just like, it's hard to, and this is a great lesson for everyone to remember, that you've got to, somebody posted something on Facebook, in my Facebook feed, and it said, you know, make sure you make friends with somebody who's from a different generation than you are, or somebody who, you know, speaks a different language than you, or, you know, just so you can be around people who are, you know, very much different than you are. You
read a fucking book. I mean, that still matters.
That matters, but it's also just, it just speaks to how easy it is for us to get into our self-curated bubbles.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though we're like, oh, we're on social media, we see a lot of things. We actually don't see stuff that we've chosen not to see. Like, we don't see, if you're liberal, you don't see a lot of the batshit crazy conservative stuff. You don't.
I do. I work around talk radio. So I see it. Phil.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the ad is ridiculous, right. But I think the ad kind of speaks to slightly bigger issues around like implicit bias,
yes. Mm-hmm.
How comfortable we are with certain, you know, just tropes that act on us even in ways that are subconscious.
Exactly.
So we don't really factor them into how we operate on a regular basis. Now, does whoever did this creative work for the Red Cross, since I doubt very seriously that the Red Cross did the work themselves, you know, they're probably in an environment where they're not even they're not really even acting on a conscious basis, but it also doesn't dispute the way they already think about the world in terms of, you know, who's causing trouble, who are the ones likely to speak out. And when you have larger issues, if you think just this past year, you know, not to, you know, make something that's just obviously so stupid more serious than it needs to be. But if I think about the, you know, pool party in Texas where right. that police officer like slams that young black girl on the ground, or that school situation where another sort of person of authority, a security guard or a police or some sort of school official takes this girl out of her chair and like
a cop.
Yeah.
He was an actual cop in the school.
Yeah.
But he was a real cop.
Yeah. And slams her down. Yeah. You know, like, we're seeing these acts of violence very nonchalantly against kids. And I'm not saying these ads are because of, like, cause that sort of behavior, but on an unconscious level, I think they do. And, you know, additionally, if you look at the rate of suspensions where you take a student body of or student examples of white students versus black students and who's suspended for what violation and at what rate and how often that happens.
And as young as preschool.
Right. you begin to start to see patterns. And again, this is one dumb ad coming out of an organization that is not exactly like a champion of diversity, despite their good work. But they lay on top of one another. And I think we always have to start challenging the perspectives that we have in the world. So it's not also about just having people in the room. That's obviously super important. But it's also about the perception and the ideology that those people are bringing into that room that are going to make the decision. So those are my thoughts on it.
F up. We got to get to what's up. All right, now we got to get to what's up. And this is still what's up. You know, on this show, we take the longer view and we're sort of trying to hack even present situations we're talking about for insights on our future, which actually helps us understand better our present. That's kind of the Two Dope Boys methodology. So we're getting to Brexit. Now, this is coming out, you know, a little bit over a week after this vote happened. There's a lot of variables here, obviously. I had a conversation with my friend Bhaskar Sankara on the Majority Report. He's the founder of Jacobin Magazine. And we had this sort of, you know, sort of neo-Marxist take on it. And there is a left-wing critique of the European Union. There is a left-wing case for leave. I think, though, that for purposes of our conversation, and we could take it wherever we go, obviously, but this is, you know, 52-48. Their win for leave. and you see the a lot of things getting conflated. You see, on one hand, I think people genuinely concerned about top-down leadership. I think you see people, in this case, empirically wrongly, because austerity in the UK was implemented by the UK government. It was not imposed by the EU, but the EU has imposed austerity and brutal fiscal programs on southern zone countries like Greece. And then you see a lot of xenophobia, obviously. And then you just see, I would say, in some ways even more simpler, you just see a basic fuck you. And I think it's actually a quite well justified fuck you, even if it was the wrong move to make. It goes back to conversations we've had about what side of the barricade are you on. And I see it as a frame of, this is just another example of institutions are failing. Mm-hmm. And we can sit back and we can be more informed and more educated and, you know, exercise our, you know, whatever, even just sort of empirical privileges we might have about the conversation, about, you know, understanding this assessment. But the anger is very, very real. And when you create this amount of anger, it could lead us to evolve or it could lead us to devolve. And that is my opinion. And that remains a very open question. So that is my frame on Brexit, and want to obviously hear what you gentlemen think.
Yeah, the Brexit is actually very personal to me. You know, my family's West Indian. Yeah. My mom's from Barbados. My dad's from Guyana, both former British colonies. Right. My parents grew up under a colonial system and in many ways kind of still very loyal to the crown. My mom has tons of royal stuff in the house, kind of a product of their time.
Yeah.
And I have close family that lives in the UK, in London and in Bath specifically. And to kind of, And I've worked in London. So when I started Influencer Conference, one of the second cities, we expanded to two cities after the first year. We did it in 2010. In 2011, we expanded to London and Berlin. And that was based off of personal relationships and business relationships. So that's just a backdrop that as much as one can kind of be an Anglophile, I think I'm that guy.
You got an Anglophile streak, I know.
Yeah,
I know
definitely. This. I know tons of great bands from London.
I got an Anglophile streak too.
So I love that scene. But moving beyond that, what really bothers me about this is that, I think you nailed it. There are legitimate concerns about the EU. I'm not sure if on a very personal level, meaning the ability for people to move freely between borders, to work, to build homes, to build lives for themselves throughout those countries that are in the EU. I think we kind of take that for granted because Americans, as much as they might travel here and there, are still fairly insular and don't really take advantage of world experiences. I'm painting with a broad brush, but I do believe that. So I think they haven't really impacted on the restriction that's going to have toward the growth of just creatives in their country. You know, there's lots of people who live in countries like Italy. They live in Germany. They live throughout the EU, and they move to places, particularly the big cosmopolitans, obviously like London, in order to have access to more people, more diversity, more opportunity. And now you're really setting yourself up for a brain drain where I think if I'm going to put on my old trader hat, you know, I'd definitely be short London or short the UK and be long countries like the Netherlands, like Germany, Sweden. I'd be putting my money
that in, have more robust safety nets in some respects than even the UK.
I think they're gonna be the beneficiaries if you're an EU citizen and London is no longer on the plate for you,
right.
I think you're gonna start to look at other countries where you can
Stockholm, you can
live and work.
Yeah.
Particularly those countries that speak English.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I'm like, the first place was the Netherlands. Because Amsterdam has like amazing English. Rotterdam, amazing English. And that's the universal language. Like, we can not like to say that, but the universal Franca is English.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
and if you're a just to continue with your Wall Street analogy, if you're a trader, an investor, you don't like uncertainty, which is why we've lost $4 trillion in GDP or whatever in the last, you know, week after this. Additionally, I do think there are this points to the fact that we live in this time of fracture. Yes. I think we live in a time that calls into question the fact are our economies built on a lie?
That's right.
You know, and somehow we have to start. Yeah, somehow we have to start exactly. Really exploring that in a way that is constructive to engagement. Part of what the UK vote was, part of what Trump's nativist appeal here is a retreat from the world, because it's not the way that we work so hard to make it. And so that's a generational divide that, you know, you've got a younger millennial kind of, hey, the world is our oyster. We can go and work and be and do and create wherever. And, you know, the ideas of collaboration, the sharing economy. I would imagine that to a lot of people who are in that older demographic that voted to leave, collaboration and sharing also sound like dependency, which is really something that is the antithesis of what they probably grew up on post-World War II-ish, thinking, well, I guess got to work hard. You know,
but the politics of the UK is a little different.
It may
be. So their whole emphasis, even on the right, which they were lying about, but right-wing politicians said, yo, £300 million that goes to the EU, we could turn around and spend it on the NHS right here. Mm-hmm. So what those people are reacting to is also the perception that, again, is accurate, that actually their jobs are gone. Their safety net is being trimmed at. And I think that not just to jump in here to frame it is I think that what you're both saying is right, but we're kind of getting sold. There is a bill of goods being sold to us and the reform that needs to happen in our business and work practices and in our design and in our strategy from policy through business is, you know, this notion that collaboration, globalization, technological linkage is inseparable from the brutality of how we've governed our marketplace and how we've slashed people's, you know, ability to have safety.
Right, right.
You know, the UK is the only country in the world, an industrialized world, that approaches our level of inequality crisis.
Oh, right. Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah. And Mark through Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Through David Cameron.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's never stopped. And I think that, you know, even in the UK, yes, with the I saw a piece that was an outlier, but a 19-year-old woman of color in the UK who was like, I voted leave because I connect this in the same way a young person would support Bernie Sanders here. And there's no one here who supports Bernie Sanders or anything else who's opposed to, you know, global travel, collaboration or anything else. But they are definitely opposed to being massively stuck in debt and having, you know, these really problematic right. structures imposed on them. And in their work relationships, they want, if you can have so much freedom, you also have to have security injected in them. So I think that, like, the only positive call from this could be trying to start charting that balance.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, in the meantime, it is completely like playing havoc with, it's going to play havoc with the lives, you know, and some people right now are saying, we're going to have to just take our medicine. It'll be tough, but it'll be better. I hope that's true, and I hope it all works out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see the folks that won the vote to leave. They're like, well, we're not trying to like invoke whatever that Article 52 is.
Article 50.
We're not trying to invoke that yet because that puts them on a definite timeline, and there's a lot to be worked out. There was an article in Fast Company that I saw today where it was talking to your point about, well, what does design talent in the UK think about this? And they're like, wow, this is really, we're concerned about the brain drain. We're concerned about the ease of people working. We're concerned about being connected to where the best ideas are and access to people. So I think you're going to see more of that when industries, particularly the creative industries, are going to talk more about, like, how does this impact what we're doing, how easy it was for us to do it. And we still, and that still does not get to the pensioner who is like, where is my real spending going?
Which or the next generation of people having design, jobs like design who have degrees and now they have debt in the UK, which they didn't have before because top-up fees got introduced. And, you know, that's what I'm saying, is that that those class issues are now in the educated creative class.
And let me just jump in here one more time is just that, you know, part of this backlash was, you know, Michael Wolff wrote a great piece, and he said part of the backlash was that the people outside of London felt like London was like, well, we know all the facts, and so this is how we should make our decision based on the facts. This was a classic case in some ways of data over context, you know, and this over-reliance on, well, we have all the data, so we can make the smartest decision.
Nerdism will not save you.
Technology is not inherently – and I use technology as this broad umbrella for all this bleeding edge living that so many of us do and can take for granted because we live in a major urban center right now. We can't – it's not going to solve it without the human sort of empathy, human engagement that is so often gets stripped out of the algorithm or is not part of the algorithm. We still have a lot to kind of deal with, and you know, whether it's Bernie Sanders or the crazy folks. I should back that up. If it's Bernie Sanders or if it's Nigel Lafarge or it's Marine Le Pen. I mean, there is something there that I think the media, the us folks happily ensconced with our high-speed internet connections have to really understand about these people who are hurting right now, and that's really real. And we need more empathy. We need more real commitment to engage. We need commitment to really ask and solve some tough questions.
Yeah. I mean, and those people are us.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah, man.
I try to not separate myself from these folks that are out there kind of feeling, you know, this shit doesn't work.
Right.
And it doesn't work because it don't work.
Right.
Like, it doesn't work not because. It doesn't work because of these particular times, or it doesn't work because we're just not doing it right. This shit just don't fucking work, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's no, you can't fix the reason people, the things that people are blaming their problems on aren't the problem. You know, the problem is money is bullshit, debt is killing people, and there's a serious, like, financialization that has occurred to all of our lives. Then it operates so much. It's kind of like the first segment about, like, bias.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you don't even recognize where it operates in your life because you assume all of this is normal. Like, you assume it's normal for you to, you know, use ATMs and be charged money for that. Like, you assume that it's normal for you to pay usury type of interest on basic transactions. Like, that's keeping someone in debt is a way of keeping you as a serf. So, that's how it works. And the people react to that. And the slippery thing is that it's both sides serving the same master.
And I would say, in addition to that, I think that everything you both said is exactly right. And I think that, yes, there is some truth too to, like, there's different ways of being on the scale, relatively speaking, where it works or doesn't work. There's true, incredible cruelty and deprivation. But on the other hand, it's like, unless you're on, like, a private jet to Turks and Caicos right now to, like, figure out the strategy to have a second Brexit referendum because you're getting paid to advise some campaign. You know what I mean? Like, unless you're, like, in that situation, really this situation doesn't work. It's just fundamentally dysfunctional across the board. And I think that the other thing that could come out of this that you will see increasingly is, you know, the same questions of, say, if you go to, like, the more, you know, younger creative class, looking at that dimension, they've also been taught that, you know, when it comes to apps and technology and what you can do, endless choice, sky's the limit. Why don't we do this with technology? Why don't we do this? You know, why don't we have it? And now at a certain point, and that's very important. That's produced a lot of cool and valuable things and allowed things like we're doing to exist. So it's important. But at the flip side, it's been like the rules of, you know, we're always going to basically cut taxes for top end people. We're not going to regulate business. We're not going to make a question about what's the scale of business and whether it's healthy or not. Those questions are never put in play. So on one hand, you've said this realm is open to complete unlimited possibility in your technological, market, personal, social, sexual life. And that's cool. But then on the other hand, the economy can't be hacked. The building blocks of the assumptions about how we design things can't, you know, yeah, of course your ATM fee is going to be ridiculous. Of course we're going to have inequality levels that actually are more than they were in the medieval time,
right.
In fact. So what you're going to start to see, I think, even in that, you know, the people who are already on the out, they're saying more definitively, fuck you. And that's going to take positive, justifiable, like left-wing forms, if I can be blunt about it. And it's also going to take some really ugly, fucked up, neo-fascistic forms. And we already see that.
Right.
But then you're going to see creatives and young people and people who are already in that privileged position, they're getting hit too. So there's a whole other question set that's going to come out of those communities as well.
I do think that the big challenge of the 21st century is going to be about civic engagement, you know, making the case for people to, despite the slippery slope that we have slipped down, to get back engaged. That means on an education issue, because we're seeing that people who voted to leave the European Union didn't even know what the EU was and what are the consequences of doing that. So they voted without knowing. There is a similar sort of, and there's always been this anti-intellectual strain over here in the United States too, that we really have to, you know, find some way to combat and engage and get people really talking about, you know, beyond emotions around issues. I mean, those have to be addressed, but we have to kind of get to some place where we can all have an objective and sensible discussion about what's going on if we're going to frame up solutions that actually can benefit everyone. And that's going to be the challenge.
Yeah, I'm super fast. I think the solutions that we need, I can't fathom them right now because the problems are so vast. And unfortunately, I wish everyone was just like ideologue racist. You know, that would make things so much easier to suss out and figure, but they're not, you know. And unfortunately, you're dealing with, you know, this is all finance. This is numbers on spreadsheets. This is numbers that exist in space. And unless we make like some Federation-esque commitment to getting rid of money, we're doomed.
So we need to figure money out. And I just have to say, the last thing is, I think we also really need to realize it's about power. And there has to be a much more serious investigation of that across the board that affects how we do organizational culture to how we design money and everything else. That is what's up. Now we got to get to what's good.
All right, now we want to jump to what's good. And I feel like the show's very lefty right now.
I think we always...
Like we're leaning left.
I think we do lean that way.
Yeah, we are.
We could also accuse us of actually literally leaning forward.
We are.
Yeah.
So BuzzFeed.
Shade.
Burn it down.
That's going to be the frame of this conversation. The leader of BuzzFeed's motion pictures, I guess studio... Z. Frank issued a public memo to his employees explaining the terms of their employment. And the rationale behind that was recently two women who have appeared in multiple videos on BuzzFeed's motion pictures platform were fired for producing content on other platforms.
Right.
And this led to this memo to help clarify basically the working arrangement that creative should have when they're operating for BuzzFeed Studios. And they cover things like ownership of content and exclusivity in particular.
BuzzFeed owns the content, and you as a producer of the content or a face of this content are exclusive to BuzzFeed.
So BuzzFeed basically owns everything you make. And they have a right for you to basically produce content for them fairly exclusively. And for those that are in creative fields, they're used to sort of bouncing around, being able to leverage their audience and leveraging their relationships and leveraging their talent across multiple platforms. And what BuzzFeed is doing in a world where getting clicks, getting that sort of content is really the only name of the game, is trying to limit their talent's ability to do that. And I think this speaks to bigger issues around the future of work,
yep,
which is something we touched on in previous segments. The copyright and content laws that currently exist, and what that means for creatives who are trying to leverage, albeit bigger platforms, to get their voices out there. And the article, which comes from Gawker by Jordan Sargent, which basically says BuzzFeed Motion Pictures needs to unionize ASAP. And the call basically is that if the creatives that work at BuzzFeed want to have a voice in the perpetuity of their content, they need to create some sort of system, possibly a union, that will allow them to have some control over their creative content. And that's sort of the frame, because as we continue to exist in this world that is more fluid in terms of definitions of work, definitions of creativity, who owns what, these issues are going to become more and more important. So I think that's the frame, mm-hmm, for how we want to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a couple things here, not least of which is that this type of creative work is not like the same. It's not the same as when somebody produces an instruction manual for your new coffee maker. It's not personality less. It is very much about the personality of the person, like who is in
the
video. I give
you those coffee instructions with personality.
Yeah, but by the time I get them, you know, come on, you know. But seriously, it, you know, there are real people, real BuzzFeed employees. To my knowledge, they don't hire actors to do this. They are using BuzzFeed employees to write, produce, to be in these videos, and you know, it's and so there is very much a this idea that people are watching the most popular videos because there is some alchemy between the writing, the concept, and the person who is actually performing in them. So if you are now the face of said content and you get 1.5 million followers like one of these folks did in this article, then you should have some kind of piece of the residual benefits of that content that you help create, because it is in many ways like working under a Hollywood system.
Exactly, and I just want to quote from it, yeah, to add to what you're saying, because it just flows perfectly. Oh. This is in the Gawker piece, right? So This is the article in Gawker is quoting Frank's memo, and then there's the sort of contextualization. So this is from Frank's memo. This is in the explanation of what the rules that are being sent out to BuzzFeed employees are. These are worth noting. Standard features of being an employee at any media or tech company, but we realize that they're different from freelance Hollywood models. This is back to Jordan Sargent. This is a neat rhetorical trick. Frank is saying that he wants his employees to produce like Hollywood talent while being treated like journalists. Very few TV writers or actors would trade their jobs to be journalists, to which I would say, indeed. And some of us are working to migrate in the opposite direction. Right. But the reality is that in that scenario, you're creating you know, a model, in fact, that doesn't even work for journalists, arguably. Mm-hmm. And you're taking, as you say, the personality and the content and trying to force it under that economic rubric. And I think that the thing that always comes up in these conversations and in so much of the work that Phil and I do, because really, like, I think part of this is, you know, empowering people to do well and succeed and to treat each other well in this cultural economy. And on one hand, there's companies and organizations that I think are going to start to try to figure out different models that actually work for people. And then on the producer and the individual worker end, I think it's very important. And this is another example of, you know, nothing new under the sun.
Right.
There's always the rhetoric of a new economy and the old issue, you know, the old rules don't apply and blah, 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 blah. But there has never been an economic arrangement where groups of workers have not had to create some type of affiliation together to safeguard their interests.
Right.
Because it is not going to happen through osmosis.
Right. It's not. And you know, it's very much a case that, these writers and these creatives are producing content that, you know, BuzzFeed videos get 2 million views off the rip. I mean, yep. If your TV show was doing that, that would be a small hit.
Yep.
You know, so in the context of other content that is out there, it's like you have to start paying people, and you have to at least start, you know, respecting that if you're not going to pay them in lieu of, you know, TV writers and actors, you know, even on daytime soap operas, they get paid pretty well.
Yep.
You know, so, and that payment is so we can monopolize your time, you know. In lieu of that, you've kind of at least got to give people the freedom, you know, and you've also got to know that they are going to want to take that fame, that visibility, if they build some up there and go on to someplace else where they can remunerate a little bit better.
But that's the situation, the rhetoric working both ways. The rhetoric of this is all right. Fluid and this is all right. Adaptive and you make your own way applies when we're not giving you health benefits or paying you as much. But when it reverses to us, then all of a sudden, that's a real old school model. You cannot freelance. Hmm. You cannot move on your own.
Which is kind of like bullshit.
Of course it's bullshit.
You know, because is anybody, because again, to our previous conversation, is BuzzFeed paying like these really attractive salaries for all these young 25-year-olds who want to work and be on video? Anybody? Right. I'll wait.
And this is the restructuring of our economics that
we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, what we were talking about earlier, like, you know, we're going to give a shout out to Jeremy Rifkin, you know,
yes, sir.
You know, zero marginal cost society, that we're entering into a space of late term capitalism coupled with technology that is making a lot of the old rules obsolete. Right. And so you're not going to be able to create the same working contracts or conditions for employees or creatives, because the underlying circumstances under which you would have created those rules have changed, and they're tipping those rules more and more in favor of the people who have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in an article they reference Matt Bellassé, who's one of like BuzzFeed's video breakout stars, and he went from having, when he was working for BuzzFeed, having a Facebook presence or a web-based presence that had 1.5 million followers, which he can then leverage, to now that he's left BuzzFeed and had to leave all of that kind of content and collateral behind, having 400,000 people. Right. And, you know, some of that is also that these platforms, though they might not make that much money, they have a certain amount of, like, mind share.
Oh yeah,
and branding that's engaged with driving people to their site. So it's the gatekeeper, gatecrasher argument we've made,
which you've published the influencer conference published.
Yeah, that. You yeah, know, influencer conference that. Published a series of essays dealing with that phenomenon, where I think the promise of the internet and a digital age was that we'll all be able to produce, we'll all be able
democratized.
To yeah,
everything will be democratized.
We'll yes. be able to democratize our creative process, but having your creative material and output out in the world doesn't mean you will be duly compensated for
it. Well, then that's the question.
And I think that's the disconnect.
That's absolutely disconnect. So the question I have for both of you is, because on one hand, because, you know, there are a couple of green shoots in this where the flip is and with some type of hybrid of like backing of some type of institutional framework, some type of mind share, and then your own ability to sort of individually group together and leverage, there is actually a path here to make like a middle class or upper middle class income in creative pursuits, which is actually like, you know, there weren't YouTube hosts making middle income before. There weren't podcasters making a middle, and that's still very rare and still comes with institutional backing, but it's an interesting path that is available now. So we should acknowledge that. But I guess in these conversations, like, it reminds me of the interview that we had with Grant McCracken, because we're talking about a lot of dark value here. Bless you, Rob.
Thank you.
We're talking about a lot of dark value here, but if you can't migrate, if it's impossible because if dark value meets zero marginal cost, and dark value, to reiterate, is the intangible values around companies, the sort of thing, and around the content
they create
and around the products they create, as Rob with his brilliant insight for some reason off mic is saying, and I'm copying from, if that meets zero marginal cost, and that contradiction hits together, where it's like, yes, there's an unbelievable amount of creativity and value here, but it ain't going to make money. Or maybe it'll make money for the people that make microphones and, you know, yeah. Video cameras,
it's,
right?
It's going to be set up in a different way.
Right. So does that start to mean that the real bold answers of the future are, you know, the future BuzzFeed say like, okay, we're going to design this as a hybrid private enterprise worker cooperative. We're going to have a flatline profit structure because there is money here. It just can't be funneled the way it's funneled,
it can't be,
or it's not
in the old way.
Exactly. And that. So all of a sudden, all the rhetoric about we're in a new world, we're in a new this, is actually going to finally start to meet reality, as in like, no, literally, we are in a new world that requires different ownership and business models to do this kind of work.
There's another guy I would reference that talks about this in a slightly more curmudgeonly way, but I think he makes a lot of good points. Bob Lefsetz, former music guy.
Still writes a lot about the music
industry. To varying success, and writes a lot about music, culture, his health. he writes about a hodgepodge of stuff, but he has a certain point of view, and maybe I'm slightly curmudgeonly, so I gravitate toward it.
Just slightly.
I'm very cynical and grumpy. Like, I totally admit that.
Look at what you say. You say it like such a teddy bear.
But I always have
been. Every time you unleash your
thing, I was a 10-year-old, like, cynic.
Cuddly. I'm very, very cynical.
I try. Guys. It's the cuteness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know.
Able to sell it that way.
Bob talked. It works, man.
I know, man.
Bob.
Phil the cuddly curmudgeon.
Yeah.
McKenzie.
Four times.
There you go. Four-time hitter. Yeah, Bob talks about this a lot, and I love reading his stuff. Even when I don't agree with what he has to say, I think he makes good points about that argument that the way we structured our digital world, it's not more of us participating. We have the illusion of more of us participating, but it's less of us participating. Yeah. There's only one Amazon. There's only one Google. There's only one Facebook.
Big Five. Yeah. We had that conversation.
Yeah, there's
big
all five of platform. Those or things.
The Big Four,
excuse me. Yeah,
you know,
where would the five be?
Yeah, there's
right.
BuzzFeed. You know, there's not a million places. There's one place. And yeah, you can be the cog in their machine, but how much of that do you own? And once you leave it, like, how much is it you being like really super fucking amazing, and how much is it that combination
the
of
machine
you,
helps yeah, you get there? Yeah,
the machine helps you get there.
Right, and you know, I don't know if you guys read Ben Thompson, his site Stratechery.
I don't, but I will now.
He does a lot of analysis of the media business and technology businesses and whatnot, and he has the whole thing called aggregation theory. And he's like, the promise of the internet was, again, that democratization. But now the way people are making money is to mimic the old media, in that they are trying to aggregate all these disparate audiences so they have mass. And there's only going to be a certain number of winners in there. It's going to be Amazon. It's going to be, you know, the things you guys have talked about, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was what Peter, you know, Peter Thiel and actually super producer before Matt was, made this point. Who, well, Peter Thiel's always been not a good guy, if I could paraphrase it, Donald Trump. I actually wrote it down. Not a good guy.
Not a good guy.
I mean, look, it's true. But, you know, his book, I mean, frankly, he's a major loser, ethically at least. But the book that he wrote, whose title is escaping me right now. He wrote Zero to One, which is his sort of like big tech success manifesto with his sort of like neo-fascist techno-utopian libertarian right. bullshit. That book is an argument for monopoly. That's all that book is. I mean, it's a peon to superficially to capitalism and the market. But the answer is how do you find your slice of this digital pie and own it to the exclusion of everybody else? And the startup culture right now, the ultimate goal for many companies is if this app can get enough leverage, Google will snatch it.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I can cash out.
So, I mean, I think the bigger things that I would say is my final point is that we really are in some respects in a new digital and economic age. That's actually true because of the mechanisms. We need to start actually updating our organizational, business, creative, and collaborative models in very real, tangible economic terms to catch up with it.
A new operating system.
Yes, sir.
Boom goes the dynamite.
That's good. Let's get to the crates.
Now we want to jump to digging into crates, and this is our time to share with you guys like something that we're digging, something that we love, something that we think will add to your intellectual prowess as you leap through your lives. And I'm going to jump off real quick with a film, a 1999 film called Black and White, which is it's a weird movie that I think actually addresses a lot of the sort of angst of culture and how people shift and exist within culture. And it has a really all-star eclectic cast. Robert Downey Jr., Mike Tyson, Brooke Shields, Elijah Wood, Scott Kahn, Ray Kwan. Like it has Claudia Schiffer,
wow.
Ben Stiller,
what?
Method Man, Alan Houston. Like it's a
oh right that movie.
It's a random movie about a bunch of uptown kids who are right, really engaged in black culture. And how they interact, move around like real hood street dudes. And I'm not going to give away the plot, but it cuts across a lot of different currents. And every time I see it, I feel like the movie was a little cornball at the time, but it's gotten better over the ensuing decade or so. And it's called Black and White. You can probably check it out on Netflix or any number of different outlets. It has an amazing weirdo cast of different people in different stages of their career. It's Robert Downey Jr. before Iron Man. It's, you know, it's a lot of interesting folks doing work that you wouldn't normally see them in. And again, the movie's called Black and White.
There's a standoff between me and Mr. Fields. You want to take the next crate, my friend?
Okay, super. I will do that. My offering for or pull from the crates is kind of going back to this whole economics discussion we've had. One of my favorite writers is a guy named Umair Haque, who formerly was with Havas in their media group. He's a economist by trade, and two books he wrote. One was The New Capitalist Manifesto in, I think, 2010. But the one I'm going to suggest for this edition, and as we talk about a new OS for the economy, is a book, a small book he put out, digital only, called Betterness. He put that out at the end of 2011, and it really talks about the need to reframe how we think about helping people to live lives that are full of meaning versus pure economic kind of there will be winners and losers.
Yeah.
There has to be something greater than that, because it's interesting too. If I look back, and he even wrote about this in 2011, he predicted much of what is happening right now, just in terms of what he called this great splintering of our society, the fracturing of the bonds of community. And it's all driven by this crazy capitalist system that says, hey, we can play the scarcity game, and we can't anymore because there's too many of us on the planet. There's too few resources. And, you know, it goes back to this idea that way back when, if we ran out of stuff here, we could go move to another place. If we ran out of fish, we could go to another pond, or we could take it from that other tribe because, hey, but now, but now this planet is very much the crowded subway car. And if a fight breaks out or somebody gets sick, it affects us all.
Yes.
And so we have to start thinking very differently. And I think this is a great and inspiring and thoughtful piece of writing. It's a very, very short book, probably about 100 or so pages, but it's really worth it in the context of everything that's been going on. And you can also follow him on Medium. He publishes very regularly, and also on Twitter at Umer H.
Yeah, he's good.
He's amazing.
Umer Hake is a bright dude.
Yeah. And an Influencer Con alum. He spoke in London in 2011.
And maybe a future Dope Boys guest.
Yeah.
Should probably talk to him at some point.
Yeah.
Phil, I need you on this because I might need some questionable Viggo Mortensen impressions for this segment, for this pick. Carlito, you don't know what it's like. So, 1993, Brian De Palma put out a flick with Al Pacino, Sean Penn, Viggo Mortensen in a John Leguizamo, Guzman. I forget the dude's first name.
Luis Guzman,
called Carlito's Way. So, which is weird because, you know, obviously De Palma made Scarface, Pacino's in Scarface. Scarface, I think, is actually a great movie for what it sort of set out to do. And it's supposed to be trashy. And as Pacino said in an interview, like, Tony Montana is not supposed to have any depth. Like, that's the point. He's supposed to just be pure appetite.
But that Giorgio Moroder score, though,
is a good score. Yes. It is a good flick.
I DJ that joint all the time. Yes. I play some joints off that.
Oh, and the opening, Castro. Oh, my God. That's such a good flick. But Carlito's Way is kind of unfairly sort of coupled as like the informal sequel to that. But the character he plays in Carlito's Way is very different than Tony Montana. He's kind of, you know, it's that classic sort of like reformed mastermind criminal role, except he's really genuinely trying to get out, but at the same time in a way where it's very masterfully rendered, because he's a very admirable person in a lot of ways, but he still is who he is. Mm-hmm. And it's still like, and that's why it's kind of not going to work. There's some scenes in there though that are just like, I don't know why so many people slept on this movie, because in addition to being just like a great gangster movie, some of it's like just Hitchcockian. Some of the scenes, there's a scene in the pool hall, there's a scene in Grand Central that are incredibly nerve-wracking. And look out for Viggo Mortensen in a wheelchair doing simultaneously a heartbreaking performance and literally a like uptown like Hispanic accent that sounds like me being like, Carlito, you don't know what it's like to not be able to fuck, man.
I was going to erase the tape.
I never portray you, Carlito, man.
It's dirty.
But it's also good. So visceral.
Yeah.
Carlito's Way. Super producer Matt Leck, thank you. Charmaine Lau, our brilliant intern.
Yeah, Charmaine be holding us down. Like,
yes.
We got to get her more on mic, but she be holding us down for real.
There's some logistics.
She's got to be like Gary Vaynerchuk's India.
Exactly.
Let's get into the show.
At Two Dope Boys Pod. You can email us about anything at, what is it? It's at twodopeboysbk@gmail.com.
There you go.
Two Dope Boys Pod, spelled out, twodopeboyspod.com. That's our website. You can find out about our consulting work. You can meet every single member of our crew, including the very four-timer, Mr. Rob Fields, who I always appreciate coming on, and I can't wait to do it again.
Just at Rob Fields or robfields.com.
And we're also on Instagram.
Yes, we are. Which I know nothing about.
Instagram/
Do It For The Gram
Pod. number two, the number two. In this number case, two. It is the number two.
Dope Boys Pod number two, kind of like Chanel number two, but like different.
What he said. Branding. See you all on Point.